Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Higher production of beef, pork, and broilers. Beef production up 130 million pounds. That's mainly higher slaughter volume and higher cattle weights driving that higher production.
Chairman of USDA's World Ag Outlook Board, Mark Jekinowski.
Pork production forecast increased by 180 million pounds this month. And that is mainly just reflecting the information that we got in the Hogs and Pigs report at the end of March. And that report indicated that farrowing intentions were not down as much as expected. The pig crop was revised higher and also indicated sustained growth in pigs per litter. So all of those factors are going to be contributing to higher pork production. Broiler production also raised this month up to 130 million pounds, and that reflects a combination of higher weights along with slightly higher egg sets and placements.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
One of the features of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was an attempt to simplify the tax code to reduce the time burden that taxpayers face in complying with the tax code.
Denny Yagan is the chief economist at the Budget Lab at Yale.
We are able to quantify that, and under current law, the average taxpayer will face a burden of 14 hours to comply with tax law. Because under current law, we lose the big standard deduction, more taxpayers are going to itemize their deductions, and that's particularly burdensome. In all three of the reform proposals, the standard deduction is maintained. There are fewer taxpayers who are itemizing their deductions, and that's showing up in a 10% reduction in the time burden of complying with the tax code. And that's the type of analysis that, you know, it's part of the reason to do tax reform. It comes up every time. And here are the estimates that we can use alongside policy decisions of the brass tax, dollars in and dollars out. Okay, so this is one innovation to bring that along into the automatic discussions of these policies as numbers come off the analyses. We also are intent on extending past the decade. So in everything we do, we will provide 30-year estimates, not just 10-year estimates. And in this graph and the last graph for Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, we're showing you estimates out to 30 years. And this graph is showing you net interest outlays as a share of GDP from now to 2055. Notice the y-axis. These numbers are very large, ranging from 3% to 8% of GDP, and we get different net interest paths. So what's going on? Under baseline, primary deficits are adding to debt as a share of GDP. That mechanically increases net interest as a share of GDP. But also there's feedback into interest rates. We're following conventions outlined that other scorekeepers use, and we're using macroeconomic modeling from the Fed's Ferbus model to analyze alterations to that baseline path. Under full extension and partial extension, which are not paid for, what happens? Well, you have higher deficits that mechanically adds to higher net interest, but then also feeds back through higher interest rates. The exact opposite happens in clausing SRN. You actually get lower interest rates through the deficit reduction relative to the baseline, and that shows up in GDP projections. So here's a mirror image graph that has different implications, albeit at small y-axis impacts, in the short and long run. So what's happening here? Under full extension and partial extension, this is a net tax cut. It's putting cash in the bank accounts of American families. They're spending it. That is an impulse to aggregate demand. That increases GDP in the short run until the Fed's inertial interest Taylor rule brings the economy back into balance. And the opposite is happening for the deficit-reducing clausing SRN proposal. That's in the short run. In the long run, what happens? In the long run, higher interest rates under full and partial extension reduce GDP modestly relative to baseline, up to 0.5% of GDP cumulatively, that's not per year, cumulatively over 30 years. And the opposite happens in clausing SRN despite the higher corporate tax rate, for example, that the interest rate effect swamps other effects from higher taxes.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Talking about break-even prices for wheat.
Kansas State grain economist Dr. Dan O'Brien.
They quoted information from K-State. We gave them the information. They quoted the full economic cost numbers, which were closer to, you know, six and a half. The actual cash cost coverage numbers, again, before you pay full cost for land, full cost for machinery replacement, you know, what you'd have for full economic cost long term, $1, $1.50 lower. So we're covering cash costs even at these levels, but in the long run, are you able to replace machinery? Are you able to buy land? Would be the issues of full economic cost. So challenge as it is, I would say that corn for the May contract has been trading in about a 425, 426 to about 450 range over the last 2 or 3 weeks, had gotten down to about 410 in February. So we're not at the very most recent low for that contract, but we're into planting season. And as we'll talk about here in a minute, dry conditions, nothing hindering the planters to roll in most of these areas, even forecast over the next week and a half. So very likely we'll get the crop in. But then the issue of concern about lack of subsoil moisture in a good chunk of the Corn Belt, the need for rain to come, et cetera, will all come into play. But again, myopically speaking, as we stand here today, we're starting to get the crop planted in these areas and not a lot of worry at present. I would say for the soybean charts, whereas for corn, we had a time back in February, basically, where we traded down to about 410 and the market at about 426, 427 as on yesterday's close. Here for soybeans, in essence, we closed down to 1134 and a quarter yesterday on the May contract, and that matches almost to the tick, to the quarter of a cent where we had been during that same period of market lows in February. So we're arguably a little bit more of a crucial time in the market for soybeans than we have in for corn. But then again, you've got the South American harvest coming on. Still arguments, differences of opinion, size of that crop. I would note in the April 11th WASDE report, the USDA projected the Brazilian soybean crop at 124 million metric tons for soybeans, projected that crop for this year at 155. You still have the CONAB in country projecting about 5 or so million metric tons lower, and projecting also lower for corn. So the USDA in their most recent report basically is pretty confident in their current numbers, unwilling to move any lower, any closer to CONAB until that in-country source, until they have more, I guess, evidence. So we'll see. But right now the market pretty determinedly trading the higher USDA numbers, and we'll see. If it proves that the in-country numbers are correct and market has moved lower for the supplies, then that would be a support for the corn and soybean markets, probably both in coming months, but it's not here yet. I would say also for wheat, I've talked about wheat futures trading here yesterday on Thursday, the 18th of April, closed at 577 and a quarter, almost exactly in the middle of the price range we've had from about 550, 552 on the low side to about just a little over six on the high side that we've been in basically since January. So we're in a torturous manner. We're going sideways, up and down, but still staying within that range. Harvest is coming up. We'll watch now all that much more with wheat, whereas we're wondering about planting conditions for corn and soybeans and sorghum coming up. We'll be looking at crop conditions, the threat of freezes still upcoming on, dryness emerging in the Western Corn Belt, and we'll see where wheat goes from there.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I'm Hunter Ehrman with Meredith Ellis and G.C. Ellis of the GBARC Ranch in Texas, winners of the 2023 National Environmental Stewardship Award. Meredith, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about your ranch and how it feels to have won this award.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much. For us to win this award is really a lifetime achievement award for our whole ranch. You know, it highlights our legacy, the three generations that are on this ranch, and just how important our natural resources and species conservation are, not only to us, but to our entire country. So it's an honor.
Meredith, tell us about some of the conservation practices that you employ on the ranch and how that contributes to long-term sustainability.
Sure. So I like to say that we don't abide by practices as much as soil health principles. So, for example, one of the principles is keep the ground covered. So however that looks in the fall or the winter or the early spring, as long as we keep that ground covered, be creative, that's what we abide by, right? But over the time, time of abiding by these principles, we've noted that we are allowing 660 other species to call our ranch home besides our cattle. We're noting that we're protecting one of the last remaining healthy, pristine watersheds in the state of Texas. And we're also, initial data modeling suggests that the way we ranch every year sequesters a net 2,500 tons of CO2. So every single year that we're allowed to ranch, we take 551 cars off the road. And so those are the benefits that rotational grazing and abiding by soil health principles allows you to achieve.
What's it been like getting back on the ranch and having your son there as well?
Yeah, so just a brief background. I left the ranch. I took it for granted after I graduated high school. I was a tomboy and I just spent all my days outside. And when I graduated, I wanted to go to the big city. I majored in business finance, of all things, which just shows you how off topic I was and not knowing what I wanted to do. But I ended up getting my master's in landscape architecture, focusing on sustainability. And it was through that that we studied broad land use patterns, so migratory patterns, watersheds, urban sprawl, and the dwindling of our native, you know, natural, what is nature, right? And every class it dawned on me, I said, oh my God, what my dad is doing is so incredibly important. And it filled me with the passion to want to come back and do the most important thing I could possibly think of, which was do what my dad does, be a rancher. And so that's what I did. The state of Texas loses around 640 acres a day to urban development. And across our nation, only 20% of our grasslands remain. And so what we are doing is we are taking care of a national treasure. And I see it not so much as my land, but my responsibility for the brief time that I'm here on this earth. And so it's a legacy. It's a conviction. It's part of my heart. And that's what I'll do. And I'm so happy to have my son right there along with me learning.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Last year, though, it felt like we were having a bit of a wake-up call where we had a variety of events from poor treasury auctions to downgrades and a big upward move in long-term rates. And it kind of felt like we were finally meeting that moment when the world was recognizing that our fiscal situation was becoming unsustainable.
Greg Epp is the chief economics correspondent for the Wall Street Journal at a National Press Club event on Friday.
Let me just put the question as broadly as possible to the panel, starting with you, Josh. How much closer is a fiscal crisis or some kind of like crunch point when you look at everything going on right now? And should we be worried?
Josh Bolton was the former director of the Office of Management and Budget, or OMB.
Fiscal policy has always been, not always been, but has been unsustainable for at least the last 20, maybe 25 years. Well, I would say with a brief exception of, with the 3 years that I served as the budget director, when everything looked entirely sustainable. But the challenge we face is that not even the best economists in America or the world, every one of them can tell us with confidence that our budget trajectory is unsustainable. And you only have to look at some of the charts that have been presented earlier today to recognize that. None of them can say when the moment of unsustainability will hit. And persuading politicians to deal with a crisis that may be inevitable, but may well not be inevitable during the 10 years in which they operate is very difficult to do on the one hand, and persuading ordinary Americans of this is even more difficult to do. All of us who care about the budget face a great challenge, both of educating the public and getting our political leaders to care enough about this issue to jeopardize their own careers.
Douglas Holtz Eakin was the former CBO director under George W. Bush.
I think the distressing part about this sort of 21st century phenomenon is that it has been, we don't have the political economy to stop the upward rise, the inevitable upward rise in debt relative to GDP or whatever your favorite metric of potential for disaster is. And that's been the source of the downgrades. No one has said the United States economy is broken. It cannot possibly find the resources to fund these national priorities. That's not the issue. The issue has been our ability to manage our finances, witness debt ceiling showdowns and government shutdowns and things like that. And so to me, the education process that Josh mentioned is the central issue. There has to be, the case has to be brought to the American people in a really direct way that the federal budget is a danger. It is a danger now. There's an enormous benefit to you and your successive generations to taking care of it. And that can then produce more consensus and bipartisan consensus over the path forward. And that's the number one priority right now.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
In terms of factors impacting the corn market, we've had pretty strong exports, really strong exports, actually, for the week ending April the 11th.
Kansas State grain economist Dr. Dan O'Brien.
61 million metric tons, basically, of U.S. corn being actually shipped, and we need about 48 to beat the USDA's pace. So, you know, we've got a South American crop coming on, but concerns about it are coming into play. Lowering numbers in country out of Argentina also with too much moisture coming in. And worries about La Nina coming on. So you've got that coming in. And grain sorghum shipments, it's on this up and down roller coaster, moved a little bit lower this week to 3 million metric tons. Need a pace of about 4 to meet the USDA's projections. But really, we're, I guess, as total shipments go relative to the marketing year, we're running a little bit ahead. So still sorghum looking pretty good. Hard red winter wheat, what we grow here, and we've been bemoaning exports for so long, Shelby, that when we have a good week, it's pretty easy to overlook it. But during the week ending April the 11th, we had about 4.8 million bushels of hard red winter wheat shipped. We need a pace of just under 4 to meet the USDA's projections. So here, after beating that market down lower and with poorer exports for months and months and months, it seems, now if we get prices at these low levels, I guess drop to the place where we're more affordable in the world market. And even hard red spring wheat had a pretty good week last week, basically 5.5 million. Bushels need about 4.4 to meet the USDA's projection. So surprising, I guess, when you hang out at low levels like this, eventually the market has to come and find value for the price, and they're starting to find it now, even at these low price levels for wheat. So that's a positive thing. Still, that market report from the USDA, in hindsight, hasn't changed a lot. I don't think I would say that there are some quote green shoots. The soybean meal export market holding pretty strong, and that WASDE report basically showed limited to no change. Well, pardon me, we did see an increase in projected exports for soybean oil, but for soybean meal, pardon me, we ended up in, I believe that number, yeah, that was unchanged. So we didn't see a drop off in soybean meal exports, and we had a pace of about, we actually shipped about 350,000 metric tons, need a pace of about 281,000 metric tons on the soybean side. So again, soybean meal side. So again, coming back to the same issue that whereas, prices in that complex generally just so again, 40 USDA projecting for this marketing year, a price of, about $380 per unit, per thousand short tons. And, that being about $50 to $70 per short ton less than we had last couple of years. And now we've got pace and movement. We're underway with field work. There's nothing in our way. We're not overwhelmed with moisture. We're getting the crop in. We have these impending issues tied in with La Nina concerns and dry subsoils that we'll eventually have to deal with, but we're not dealing with them yet. The market, has every right to trust that things will be normal. We'll get normal rains. We won't have any problems, but it'll have to come. So we'll see where that's at. We still have this impending question about South America we keep talking about because we haven't seen that reconciliation yet. So we'll see where that comes.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
There absolutely is oversight.
Bill Gilland is president and CEO of the Cotton Board.
I just talked about the spring meeting where we essentially are looking forward to next year, and we're coming up with recommendations as to what to do then. As we progress through this year, we will continue to refine next year's budget until we get to August. We have a meeting in August where we'll look at details of that budget. And then in December, we will have a look back on what the program did in 2024, evaluate it, see whether it was, you know, the things that needed to be done, which kind of gets me back to our recommendations, Tony, if you don't mind me getting into them for this year. We got fairly serious this year. We looked at where the industry is, what's going on, and the Cotton Board's first recommendation was that the program has to do a better job on enhancing demand for cotton. We just have to. We've had many successes on this over the years, but we're at a lull right now. So we need to punch that button. We need to get demand going, downstream demand. And then second, we're putting a larger priority on being sure Cotton Incorporated is doing everything possible to enhance industry profitability. And that's critical. Growers are finding it very, very hard to be profitable growing cotton. Our downstream retailers, things are pressing them just as hard, I think, in terms of profitability. So we have to be sure that we're making cotton a more profitable alternative for both growers and for downstream users. And all that's kind of led the Cotton Board to the conclusion that it's time we took a hard look at everything we're doing as a program. You know, just because something's worked in the past doesn't mean it's still serving the stakeholders of this program today. Like I said, the current climate in the U.S. cotton industry demands that the research and promotion program dig deeper. But we've got to ask, is our consumer marketing plan sound? Can we find ways to make it more effective? On the ag research side, should we shift some focus toward yield growth? Because, you know, that's very important for our competitiveness and for producer profitability. International trade is undergoing substantial shifts right now. I know that your, you know, viewership and is well aware of that. And how are we addressing those shifts? What must we do to sell more cotton to consumers here and around the world? I mean, we've got to really kind of come to grips with these questions now, Tony. There's one other thing. There's another component to the headwinds I think we're facing as an industry. It's kind of hard to say this to sum it up, but cotton's reputation has to be defended too. And we must ensure that our programs aren't blocked out of some markets because of environmental or some kind of other concerns. But, you know, the good news on that front is that we don't really have to fix our production methods because we're probably the best in the world at what we do, but we do have to communicate that, Tony. People aren't just going to take our word for it. So, you know, I think the program, the council, others have plans, ways that we can communicate that, But we've got to get, we have to become aware that it's necessary that we do. And I think it's also a feather in our cap that we don't have to change, but all we really have to do there is communicate. Like I said, we think we're facing significant headwinds. We've got to get more competitive. We can't rest on any kind of past laurels. And I can tell you that the leadership of the Cotton Board and all of our members and alternates are intent on ensuring that we make the best decisions going forward.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Month-over-month increases in both production and price of meats per USDA's April forecast, with one exception.
Virtually unchanged forecast for turkey production this month, and with turkeys seeing a persistent poor demand outlook for turkey, unfortunately, and those prices have been under pressure as a result. Year-over-year, turkey prices were looking at 2024 compared to 2023, down by about 35.8 cents per pound.
World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jankowski says both steer and hog prices rose well over $2 per pound this month, both based on strong demand. Despite the fractional increase in beef production for March, year-over-year production remains down. Total meat exports are up from the previous month, due primarily to increased export demand for pork.
Increased competitiveness for U.S. product with the EU and many markets contributing to this increased demand for U.S. pork.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.